Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. It's official. Donald Trump has been sworn in as President of the United States. The day after, millions of women took to the streets to raise their voices in protest. This week, I'm joined by Michelle Taylor, one of the speakers featured in Philadelphia's Women's March, as well as Micah White, one of the co-creators of Occupy Wall Street, about what happens now that the marches are over. How do we keep the momentum going? Also, what's the future of capitalism? But first, Jeremy Slevs.
Hello.
The Slevs is back, and I feel like the name of this segment, in case you missed it, should probably be renamed, Who is Donald Trump Screwing This Week?
I think that would be a good name. Yeah.
I think that that would be more concrete and illustrative of what we're actually going to be talking about week to week.
Yeah, or how could you have missed it?
Well, it's easy to miss a lot of what's happening because it's. I feel like we got to stop saying drinking from a fire hose. We need a more dramatic metaphor.
Yeah.
There's an avalanche.
Drinking from an erupting volcano.
Yeah. That's good. Being drowned at all times by lots and lots of heavy, poisonous water that's drowning you.
Yeah, drowning in sewage.
Drowning in sewage.
We could get really dark.
We could get really dark. Well, it is dark.
Yeah.
But so in this edition of Who is Donald Trump Screwing This Week, Jeremy, who it's a long
He's
list.
Off to an auspicious start.
So who do we pick first?
Yeah. So let's start with immigrants, because I think this was one of the most high profile promises of the campaign. And there's been a lot going on in just the first few days of his presidency. So he signed an executive order calling for the construction of a border wall.
The big, beautiful wall.
Right. With a door. That will say Trump, apparently.
A golden door.
A golden door. Of course, you can't actually fund a border wall without Congress's approval. And of course, the big promise on the campaign was that who was going to pay for it?
Mexico.
Which you also can't force a country to do. Now, Mexico's president has already canceled a visit to the United States because of this wall. Just a couple minutes ago, Donald Trump's press secretary said they were going to pay for it with a 20% tax on all Mexican imports. It turns out that's not a real thing. That was pulled from the Republicans' tax plan, which would get rid of all corporate taxes and just tax all imports at 20%. So that's the border wall.
So anything else screwing over immigrants this week from Trump?
Yes. So the
I knew the answer was going to be yes, just to be clear when I asked that question.
There were two executive orders on immigrants. Another one said that anyone crossing the border, including families seeking asylum, which are people who are protected under international law, who are fleeing violence in Central America in many cases, that even they have to be detained immediately. And it also took aim at sanctuary jurisdictions, cities that, you know, helped undocumented people, immigrants from federal law enforcement. So it's going to strip all grant money from those cities.
So who else is being and I should just say we're being glib, right? Like, and I'm particularly being glib,
yes,
because in sort of being humorous about the way that we're presenting this is very serious stuff. A lot of people are very scared right now, wondering what's going to be the future for them, for their families, for their relatives. But it is just astounding how many groups of Americans Trump has managed to personally threaten within just a handful of hours, really, since he was sworn in.
Yeah, so I think it's hard to process.
It really is. So, and for me, gallows humor is often what I use. Maybe not the choice for everyone, but here at Talk Poverty Radio, that's how I'm coping. Who else is getting screwed?
So the environment, the planet, and everyone living in it is also getting screwed. I guess that's a broad group. All EPA grants, you know, any funding for the Environmental Protection Agency were halted. So that's one thing, which I don't think is getting a lot of coverage. Higher profile was the fact that he reversed the decisions on both the Keystone Pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline.
And the Obama administration had responded to environmental groups and other protesters by reversing course on Keystone and Dakota Access, saying we're not going to move forward with this construction because it will hurt the environment, it will hurt people.
Right. Which would spew really toxic oil into the environment. So, and
The sewage that we're drowning in, literally.
Yes, that's the literal sewage. I think we just closed the loop on our metaphor.
That's what I try to do most days. Okay, we can go home now. So who else is being screwed over by Trump this week?
So all women around the world's ability to make their own reproductive health choices they're also being screwed.
How is he doing that?
So there was a ban called the gag rule, a ban on all funds to any group internationally that promotes or talks about abortion procedures, or let alone performs them. That will restrict access to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, women around the world.
Accessing control over their own bodies.
Right. And not to mention, it is likely, most estimates suggest, to increase the number of abortions by banning this access to information.
Anyone else being screwed by Trump this week, Jared?
Well, anyone who has a job that is involved in the federal government and anyone who works in the economy, which the federal government is a huge part of, will also be directly harmed because there is a federal hiring freeze now in place, which will not only cut jobs for federal workers, it will also slow down the economy. It will also make us less safe because workers prevent cyber attacks. They're in charge of food inspection and drug inspection. So that's the next one.
And the hiring freeze also maybe not an issue for you just if you're a federal worker, right? Or, but maybe if you live here, as you mentioned, for the reasons you laid out. But also if you're, say, a veteran, right, veterans are disproportionately employed by the federal government. Or if you're, say, a person with a disability and you're trying to get benefits from Social Security facing massive backlogs that are only going to get worse.
Or even if you go to a national park, or if you get the mail, some basic fundamental day-to-day roles of government are going to be rolled back.
Okay. So far, I think, just to recap, we're at everyone is so far being screwed over.
We've got everyone in the world, immigrants,
women.
Everyone in the U.S. who relies on the government, which is everyone.
I feel like you're constructing this amazing Venn diagram, which is like it's all people. And now we've like.
Yeah. And then there are little spots of other people in it.
But you're also not even done because you've got a couple more.
No. There are also people who get health care.
Oh, good.
Which so there was an order that said we'll ease the regulatory burdens of the Affordable Care Act.
That was Trump's wording.
That was Trump's wording. What it means is basically giving the Secretary of Health and Human Services and other agencies more leeway not to actually implement or enforce the Affordable Care Act.
Basically, Trump was saying, hey, as one of my first acts as president, I know Republicans in Congress are working overtime trying to pull health care away from 32 million Americans. But I'd also like to just remind all my federal agencies that they should be doing everything they can in their power to pull health insurance away from Americans while Congress is doing what it's doing.
Yes. And I will just add a kicker, because these are the ones that have already happened. Now, he was supposed to issue more executive orders today. They abruptly canceled the signing.
You keep giving away what day we tape. Today is Thursday. So on Thursday, he was supposed to sign some. You say spoiler every week. Like, people don't get this every single week, Slebs. If this is a stout, at least you're consistent. I mean, so on Thursday, he was supposed to issue a whole bunch of executive orders.
Yes, on Thursday, days ago. I can barely even remember it. It was so long ago.
But what happened? He didn't.
So he was expected to have an investigation into voter fraud, which of course is made up.
Oh, because he claimed that 2 to 3 million.
3 to 5 million.
Three
people,
to 5 million. The number keeps rising. Americans
voted
illegally.
Fabricated.
In the
that is false. Right. So he canceled the investigation. Good news for now. There are multiple reports
into nothing. Right.
There are multiple reports that have been discussed in the media that he's expected to indefinitely block all Syrian refugees from coming into the country and bar all refugees from the rest of the world for at least 120 days. This is reminiscent of his campaign plan of a so-called Muslim ban, which was effectively what blocking people from exclusively a Muslim country from coming into the country would do.
Now, we didn't mention one other group that is definitely being screwed by Trump, and that would be facts, right? So now I appreciate that you led with and walked through a whole bunch of actual things that Trump is doing that are hurting people. Of course, everyone has by now heard of the White House press secretary's first briefing in which he blatantly lied about a number of things ranging from the small like crowd size at the inauguration to the more significant and then effectively waged war on the media by saying you guys just don't like us and that's why you keep saying we're lying. And then one of Trump's senior advisors, Kellyanne Conway, actually came out and said, they weren't lies. They were alternative facts, but I particularly appreciate, which was ridiculous.
Well, we do live in an alternative universe, so I guess we have alternative facts.
But we don't, though, because actually there are facts and there's one set of them.
There's an objective physical world.
There is. And I appreciate, though, that you actually led with all the stuff Trump is really doing as opposed to the sideshow that came out of
I'll just say in the like 20 seconds we have left, I think that it's in itself is a distraction. By making up things and throwing out innuendo and making up facts, which everyone will then try to fact check, we are being distracted from what he is actually doing to human beings every single day.
Which is why I am thanking you. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for thanking me.
You're welcome.
So, Slevs, come back next week.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll have some more alternatives to the alternative facts that are the things that Trump is actually doing. But all the ways Trump is screwing you. Come back next week.
Fun times.
But next up, Michelle Taylor speaking about her experience participating in the Women's March. Stay tuned.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. What started as a small idea on Facebook ballooned into a worldwide call to arms. Last Saturday, the day after Donald Trump's inauguration as President of the United States, women all across the planet took to the streets to object to Trump's damaging policies and hateful rhetoric. But how can we harness the energy from the Women's March and channel it into a broad-based and continuing movement? Here to help us look ahead is Michelle Taylor. She's a community organizer from New York City and the program manager for Witnesses to Hunger. She's also probably someone you follow on Twitter as Feminista Jones. Michelle, thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I should
it's
say
always
for
a pleasure.
Coming back because you've been on the show before.
So, oh, you're all friends.
You're a friend of the show. We're upgrading. Friend of the show. So I have to say, D.C. probably got the most attention from national news media of the women's marches, but there were huge marches in cities across the United States, including in Philadelphia, and you were part of the Philly Women's March. Tell us what it was like to be part of it, to speak at it. What was the experience like?
That was pretty amazing because they estimated that Philadelphia had about 50,000 people show up, which is, you know, fantastic, right? It's one of the larger marches that they had. And, you know, knowing how they put everything together, I mean, many of the organizers, this was the first time they'd done anything like that. And I thought it was really, really great to see people of all ages and, you know, racial backgrounds and class. I mean, there were so many men there as well. It was pretty fantastic. And, you know, when I was asked to speak, you know, I was excited. I love doing stuff like that, you know, but kind of standing on the stage and just seeing how many people were there was like, it was pretty awesome.
So what was the message that you personally were seeking to send by marching?
You know, I when I was speaking, because I was speaking more than marching, I get a bit claustrophobic in those kinds of crowd situations. But one of the things I was talking about is, you know, basically this idea of intersectionality and how as women, you know, we have a lot of common experiences and a lot of common goals. But we also have to confront issues of like race bias, class issues, you know, trans identity, just all kinds of things, immigration status that we really have to kind of work on if we're really going to talk about true solidarity. And so my messaging was really like don't forget the women of color who have been feminists for a long time and have been marching. Like, you know, in Philadelphia 20 years ago, there was a march where there were 750,000 black women that came and in Philadelphia, and there's so many people who don't even remember that it happened. So, you know, my messaging was like, let's make sure that we are open and we are acknowledging everyone's efforts, you know?
Well, and since you raised that intersectionality, I mean, it predicts my next question. I know that you're a mind reader, but in this one, you really are, because a huge part to me of one of the limitations of the ways that feminism is often portrayed or viewed is that it's about white women. Or, in a related manner, as far as kind of siloing and limitation, it gets viewed as being only about so-called women's issues, whether that's reproductive rights or pay equity or other related kinds of fights. But there were a lot of issues underpinning the marches across the country. You mentioned just a few of them now, but also worth mentioning mass incarceration, disability rights, LGBT equality, healthcare, immigrant rights, Islamophobia, climate change, and all of these were being discussed and on a national stage as feminist issues. Does this speak to you as reflecting a big tent feminism? And if so, what is the significance of that, both for the narrowly and the broadly conceived women's issues of our time?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Definitely. Sometimes when we talk about feminism, we'll write like white feminism with a little trademark after it, because, you know, there has been this image that, you know, feminism is only for white women, when there's enough research and evidence showing that feminism has existed among communities of color for, you know, all over the world for way longer than, you know, even the word was coined. And so it's like, okay, so how have we modeled this idea of, like, you know, gender equity and, you know, those kinds of things in non-Western societies? And we need to look back and really kind of stop being ahistorical about that and look at the blueprints that, like, black women and Native women and, you know, Latino women have set. And so I think that's important. But it's also, you know, what I've really, really loved in recent years, and I credit social media with that, is how people who have long been ignored are now being heard in these kinds of spaces. So when you mentioned, like, disability advocates, you know, when I was at the Philly March, I was hearing women say, you know, where's the ADA seating? And they had, you know, a sign language, you know, interpreter there. Those kinds of things, I think it's because women are pushing and they're like, listen, no, we need to be included as well. And so we had, you know, trans women speaking there. It's like, they need to be included as well, you know, and we can no longer have these tables where we're leaning in and having conversations about feminism, but when you're looking around the table, you're not representing all women. You know what I mean? I think that's kind of where we've gotten, is that understanding that there is no feminism if all women are not included in this. And also getting the support of men and understanding how feminism benefits them as well. And I think that's, you know, there's a lot of work being done around that. And some people, they've kind of taken that as their particular path. But I think all of that working together is really how we're going to form that solidarity we need to make sure that all of these issues affecting women are covered.
You know, I think back to my years in college and to women that I was in classes with or that I got to know in extracurricular activities outside the classroom. And I remember having just so many incredibly frustrating and disappointing conversations that I didn't understand, certainly not at the time, and to this day, I still don't really fully understand, where women my age who were progressive or liberal or they and cared about issues such as women's equality, such as pay equity, reproductive justice, but who did not identify or want to be labeled as feminists. There was this aversion to that term. And sometimes they would actually push back and say, well, I'm not a feminazi, a really disparaging and horrible term that sometimes gets thrown around.
It's awful.
Do you feel like that it is changing and that the amazing outpouring of support and engagement for and with the women's marches across the globe reflects a change with younger women, millennial women coming up who are prepared to identify with the F word?
And that's one of the things that I've been really working on. And people ask me, you know, as a black woman, why don't you identify as womanist, which we know has been generally the term that black feminist women have used. And I said, well, you know, it's not that I don't associate or identify as a womanist, but I assert my right to call myself a feminist and a Black feminist. And I have the right to access feminism just like anybody else. And I know that there's been a lot of fear because the word feminism has been associated with white, upper class, cisgender, heterosexual, you know, rights movements. And so many people cannot connect with that. And so they've really pushed that back. But then there's people like me who are saying, no, 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 we have access to that as well. And I am a Black feminist, and I am a Chicana feminist, and I am a millennial feminist, and I am a queer feminist. And I think that we all have the right to kind of reclaim feminism for ourselves. And I think that's what you're seeing, particularly among younger women. And I think also, again, I'm going to go back to social media, Rebecca, you know, the messaging, and as we're able to get it out in the community that we're able to build in spaces like Twitter and Facebook are making, you know, more women feel comfortable really kind of fully embracing this. And not just women, men as well. They're learning more. Those stereotypes are being broken down. People are really seeing what feminist work is about. And they're like, you know what? I am for this. Forget the stuff that I've heard before. This is where it's at. And I think when you have folks like me and others who are quite outspoken about it, we're teaching people things. Minds are changing. And I think that's where the direction that we're moving in.
So on a lighter note, I just have to ask, there were a lot of amazing signs, many of which actually went viral on social media. I really particularly enjoyed the little kid who had the sign that said, I like naps, but I stay woke.
he was so cute.
Did you have any particular favorites?
You know, there were quite a few that I liked, but I'm going to tell you, there was this image at Philadelphia of this young girl. She couldn't be more than 4 or 5 years old, and she was standing in a Wonder Woman costume, and her fist was up in the air, and in the background was like the backdrop for the Philadelphia March. And I posted that picture on my Instagram. It was just one of the most gorgeous pictures that I've ever seen. It was like this promise for the future that these girls are going to be superwomen when they grow up. And it's so inspiring to me for like us to bring our kids to these kinds of events. So, you know, I think we're talking like image. I think that was probably more so than the signs that moved me. I mean, the signs were really funny. Some of them I actually didn't like. I thought it was just doing a little too much, but that image really kind of sealed the deal for me.
So the march was not without its critics. And I would be remiss if I didn't actually call out one in particular who just pissed me off so much with a tweet that I feel proved everything that the marchers were there for and were about, which was Eric Erickson. He's a conservative leader who seems not to know what to do with women mobilizing and having power. He tweeted that there was I'm paraphrasing here, but not by much, that he felt badly for all the ham and cheese out there that wasn't getting made into sandwiches because of all of the women marching. What would you say to Eric Erickson if I had him here on the line with you right now?
I'd probably ignore him, because what kind of ignorance is that? Like, sometimes you can't dignify responses like that. But there's this idea that, you know, women should be in the kitchen, right? That's the anti-feminist thing. Go get in the kitchen, right? And what I would say to him, if I had to speak, was I would point him to all the men who were saying, listen, I'm going to be at home. I'm with the kids today. My wife or my partner has, you know, her friends are coming down. I'm just making sure they're taken care of, and I support them from over here. Because there were a lot of men that were like, that's my role today, is to kind of just be supportive back here and let them go and do what they need to do for themselves. And I really appreciated that, you know, not saying that, you know, the men shouldn't have been there, but I just think that recognizing that there's a need for that and the men saying, look, we got it. Don't worry about it. We got your back. Do what you got to do. And we'll be here when you get back. I thought that that was really excellent. And so they were the ones that were in the kitchen, and they were the ones cleaning up the house, you know, and I point him to those men. But honestly, like, those kinds of comments, I see them all the time. And I just, no, you're stuck where you are. We're moving forward. A lot of times when we start to focus on those kinds of detractors, that becomes busy work that takes us away from the work that we need to do to make forward progress. And that's why I caution folks. Always look out for the people that are trying to distract you from moving forward by upsetting you so much that you feel the need to respond and engage and argue. I don't do that anymore. I stay focused on what's next.
Are there efforts underway to keep up the incredible momentum so that it doesn't fizzle in the wake of the march?
Yeah, from what I've noticed, they are the organizers of the Women's March are rolling out action plans and different actions that people can take to continue pushing legislation and, you know, calling on the government to do its job, which is to represent the people. And right now, we barely have an executive branch, but, you know, once that gets filled in, those people are going to be held accountable for representing the people. So I have noticed that they have laid out plans. I know within my own work with Witnesses to Hunger, we just did a whole month of like training and getting, you know, really familiar with community organizing and engaging legislators. And we're going to be moving forward with our work. Like, it's really about like, let's just keep going. Let's keep going. Let's think about the next step. Okay, we had this great march. So now we know that there's going to be midterm elections coming up. There's going to be, you know, special local elections coming up in different spaces. How do we remain aware? Today in Philadelphia, we are protesting because the Republicans are meeting at the Lowe's, you know, hotel. So there's been protests all day long. You know, the Women's March, they tweeted about that. I think it's kind of amplifying those different efforts that are happening around the country and getting people to support them and keeping that momentum going, because we can't let up on this.
Michelle Taylor is the manager of Witnesses to Hunger in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. She was one of the speakers at the Philadelphia Women's March. And Michelle, I look forward to having you back on the show soon.
Oh, thank you so much, Rebecca. Take care.
Take care.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Protest is broken, or at least that's the idea that Micah White, an activist and co-creator of the Occupy Wall Street movement, explores in his recent book, The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. Micah joins the show today to talk about protest and how we can retool it to change society in a radical, progressive way. Micah White, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
So your book is somewhat dramatically titled. The End of Protest is you're not really hiding how you feel about the state of the phenomenon. But you have a very interesting kind of wording you use in looking back on Occupy Wall Street, a movement that you were deeply involved in. And you describe it as a constructive failure. What do you mean by that as you look back on Occupy?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the core thing that I'm trying to get across to people is that Occupy Wall Street was basically, it was the realization, it was the consummation, it was basically the perfect example of the social movement that activists have been trying to build for decades. You know, activists have been chasing this story, which is basically, if you can get enough people into the streets, largely nonviolent, then, you know, then our elected representatives will have to listen to us. And, you know, we did that with Occupy Wall Street. It spread to 82 countries. There's millions of people involved. Like, it was insane. You know, it was totally insane, if people remember 2011. But it didn't create the change that we wanted. And so what I'm trying to say by constructive failure, I'm not saying it's a total failure. Obviously, it changed the discourse. It helped give Bernie Sanders a platform and all this kind of stuff. But it didn't achieve its revolutionary goals. It was constructive because it taught us that we don't have to chase that same activist storyline that we've been doing for decades. We can start to tell a different story. We can start to look for new tactics. So I think it was really great that it failed. I mean, I wish it had succeeded, but I think it's really great that it failed if we can learn from it.
Well, so unpack what you mean by that it's great that it failed. I mean, I think that the main criticism that usually gets lobbed at Occupy as people who were supportive of the movement, who were in many cases part of the movement, but who look back on its failure and try to understand why, the consensus view tends to be that it was because it didn't have clear leadership with a set of demands that it was galvanizing modernized in an infrastructure that it was that it could move forward. Is that a fair criticism? Do you agree with it? And is that something we should learn from?
Okay, I mean, I think that, and I've heard that quite a bit. I don't think that that's exactly accurate as to what really happened. I think that you have to realize that every time people protest, what they're doing is they're testing a theory of social change, okay? And so when we were protesting with Occupy Wall Street, we were basically testing a theory of social change, which is that, and it was a theory that would basically combine the Arab Spring with what was going on in Spain at that time. It was basically this idea that if you can basically set up these general consensus-based assemblies in places of symbolic importance, then you will somehow manifest a higher form of democracy that your governments will have to listen to. And, it sounds naive, and I think that we tested that, and it turned out to be not true. But I think that it's not what the essential point here is that it's the reason why Occupy failed isn't because it lacked leaders or because it lacked demand. It's because there is no path to power through protest alone. You have to go even deeper than Occupy. Even if we had had leaders, even if we had had a single demand, I still think it would have failed. I think that it's the deeper issue here is that you can't go from people in the streets to somehow they have power. It doesn't exist in our world anymore. It may have existed in the past, but it doesn't exist anymore.
So a huge part of why I wanted to have this discussion with you as part of this week's episode following the women's marches that really swept not just Washington, not just cities across the U.S., but really the globe, is some particularly compelling views that you voiced as part of an op-ed that you wrote for The Guardian a few days ago. And that was that without, and I'm going to use your words here, without a path from protest to power, the women's march will end up like Occupy. Describe what you mean by that, and what are you hoping people take from that cautionary tale?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, that op-ed, it went insane, like insanely viral, like literally over 200,000 shares. I just heard from my editor that it was viewed over 500,000 times. So 500,000 people at least looked at this article. And so I think it really hit a nerve. And I think that what I'm trying to get across is that activists today act as if we live in some sort of, repressive regime like China where they don't want us to protest. And what I'm trying to get across is that people like Donald Trump, they want us to do one-day marches because they're completely not threatened by it, okay? Just like George Bush wasn't threatened by the one-day march in 2003 against the Iraq War, and Obama wasn't threatened by Occupy, wasn't threatened by Black Lives Matter, Donald Trump also is not threatened by this behavior. And so if we want to actually gain control of the state in order to change how it functions, then we need to actually consider, well, how do you actually gain sovereignty in this world? And there's only two ways to gain sovereignty. You can win elections or you can win wars. And you can use protests in conjunction with winning elections or in conjunction with winning wars, but protest alone doesn't work anymore. And that's what I'm trying to get across. And I think that, we're seeing it happen with the Women's March. I mean, it's only been a few days and already it's like, it's over, and I think people have that sense. I mean, they don't want to believe it yet, but it's over. It's not coming back. And we're already prepping now for a march of scientists, a march of climate activists. It's really, we've got to stop pretending like these big marches are some sort of achievement. They're not an achievement. We're going to see them all the time. They're just the new normal.
So then taking from that, I mean, I think I would respectfully disagree that actually there is an achievement in even holding the march. But I would agree with you that it's not just the march itself that is going to achieve something, that protest alone, as you said, is not what is going to be the vehicle for change. What would you like to see as you envision what comes after this march? What would the ideal path to power from protest be in the case of the Women's March? And what it symbolized.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to look at, so what are activists really good at right now is that we are extremely good, this is so clear ever since 2011 with Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring, we are so good at creating memes that basically jump from the internet onto the streets. Like I think that I agree with you, it's an achievement to create the Women's March in the sense that it proves that that idea was only floated in like November. So within 3 months, you can get 4 million people into the streets. That's kind of insane, right? So it's insane. It's insanely cool, but we have to figure out, well, what's the purpose of doing this? And what I'm trying to say is that we can use our ability to create social movements to actually win elections. And basically what it means is it means changing what we consider the behaviors of protest to be. Like right now, everyone knows that when you go to a march, you make some signs, you walk this direction, you wear, you know, certain colors. But we can also say when you're at the march, you sign petitions to create a third party. You know, you only need 1 million signatures to get a third party on all 50 state ballots, which is something that the Green Party was unable to do in the last election. There was 4 million people on the streets during the Women's March. So it's conceivable that we could have said, okay, everyone, in addition to the signs and all this other stuff you do, the pussy hats and all this kind of stuff, make sure you sign that petition to get a women's party on the next, on the ballot. So I think that it's part of it's just recoding what we do as activists. What behaviors do we do? What behaviors will actually give us power? And the behaviors that will give us power are the creation of a new party and voting. I mean, that's literally what it is.
When to that last point, whatever one might think about whether creation of a third party is going to bring change, there are a lot of divergent views there on both left and right across the political spectrum. The issue of voting, one of the criticisms that was routinely lobbed at Occupy and at the Occupy protesters themselves is that they were willing to show up and to camp out and to put their bodies in the streets and in the parks for long stretches of time, but that they weren't necessarily engaged in the political process and that many of them actually hadn't voted and weren't people who were registered to vote. The same question has been raised about the women who turned out and really the humans who turned out for the Women's March, many of whom were not women, that many of them had not voted, and particularly in light of some of the very dissatisfying demographic election returns analysis that we've seen in terms of women and particularly non-college women having turned out in large numbers for Donald Trump. So what message would you like to send in a way that is not just more rhetoric telling people go vote, but that is something you think that could actually change that behavior if coming from the organizers and the many folks who were engaged in this march?
Okay, well, it's, you know, I think that you have to again go back to this question of the theory of social change. So, I mean, what happened in 2011 is that the people of Spain, they went into their squares, they set up these general assemblies, and they had an election, a national election, right around the time of their movement, and that one of the popular slogans back then was, you know, you don't represent us, basically. We're not engaging in the political process, okay? And what happened is that the right wing swept into power, okay? It's eerily similar to what happened now in America. The right, they didn't engage in the electoral process. The right wing got into power. So what did they do, though? What they did is they created a social movement called Podemos. And now Podemos has become a major political force in Spain. And so within the span of just 5 years, they have actually created, I think it's like the third largest political party in Spain right now, and it's amazing. Okay, so they learned from that mistake, and what I'm trying to say is that a lot of revolutionary activists, myself included, you know, we get very wary about talking about electoral politics because we think that immediately means reform, and I think that we have to understand that if you want to create a revolution in this country, the first step to that is grabbing control of the state. That's the first step. Okay, that's what we're seeing Donald Trump do right now, you know? So we have to be able to do that first step. We have to be able to create social movements that can win elections. There is no other option. And I think that you just have to, you know, as an American activist, you just got to tune into what's going on in Europe. They have the Podemos in Spain. They have the Five Star Movement in Italy. They have the Pirate Party in Iceland. These are concrete examples of what activists should be trying to do in our own country.
And in the last minute or so that I have with you, some number of weeks ago, as part of this series we've been doing on the show about resistance, spoke with Ezra Levin. He's a good friend of mine. He's also one of the co-creators of the Indivisible Guide to Resisting Trump, which has really, in many ways, either sparked or, depending on how you looked at it, tapped into a broad movement. There are now more more than 3,000 indivisible groups. They're in every congressional district, every state, seeking to push back, to fight. And protest is not the core tactic highlighted by that guide, nor is it the main medium or strategy that they are using to try to highlight their not just disagreement with the Trump agenda, but to achieve their goals, which is actually stopping the agenda. And Ezra's strong view and what he and his colleagues put in that guide as a call to action is that progressives need to learn from the Tea Party as an example of an incredibly effective resistance movement. Do you agree with that? And do you think that that's what progressives need to be doing right now as we seek to actually achieve change rather than just headlines?
I do agree with that. I mean, I think that the key thing here to understand is that worldwide, globally right now, we're basically, there's two paradigms that are in conflict. There's two visions of populism. On the one hand, there's authoritarian populism, which is Donald Trump, Putin, the president of the Philippines who keeps killing drug dealers, drug users. And then there's another vision of populism that I think is bubbling up. It was a vision of populism that was embraced by Occupy Wall Street, the vision of populism that's embraced by Podemos in Spain and a pirate party. And this is the idea that the people themselves, basically it's a democratic populism, that the people themselves should decide how things go. So I think that the most important thing to realize is when we talk about electoral politics, what we're trying to do is actually elect a social movement into power rather than a single charismatic individual like Donald Trump or even like Bernie Sanders. This is why I kind of go a little bit different direction there. So I do think that they're right. I think that, though, that the key thing to remember as activists is how do we give the social movement the power and maintain the power within the social movement rather than just elevating a single charismatic individual. And that's, I think, one of the things that the Tea Party did wrong. But I do think that the general spirit of that thrust that you described is correct.
I've been speaking with Micah White. He is one of the co-creators of the Occupy Wall Street movement and the author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. Micah, thank you so much for joining the show, and I appreciate your views and your willingness to look back with a critical eye on the movement that you helped start.
Thank you, Rebecca. It was very interesting.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. If you work hard and play by the rules, the sky's the limit. At least that's what we're told. But with 1 in 3 Americans struggling to make ends meet or living paycheck to paycheck in this country, many now feel that that bargain is at risk, and so is the middle class that it's built. A new report by the Aspen Institute lays out a vision of a so-called new capitalism to ensure that work is a mutual enterprise for workers and businesses. But is this really possible? I'm joined by Ethan Pollack, the research manager for the Future of Work Initiative at Aspen and one of the authors of the report. Ethan, thanks for joining the show.
Oh, Rebecca, it's great to be here.
So last year, a big poll made a huge splash. It was everywhere, it seemed. And that poll found that a majority of millennials, of which I am admittedly one, I think you might be one as well.
I am as well.
That a majority of millennials now actually reject capitalism. Now, before we even get into what that means and whether that means that the next generation of this country rejects the current system that we're built on, what is capitalism?
Oh, man, that's a good question. So, first off, I'm really delighted to be here. I'll just have the disclaimer that, when I'm talking about the paper that we'll be talking about in a moment, I am kind of speaking for the program and for Aspen. On questions such as these about the nature of capitalism, I'm going to be talking a little more from my own personal
kind of... It'll be more fun that way.
I think it's going to be a lot more fun.
Take it away. What is capitalism?
What is capitalism? I see capitalism as a system of a exchange of goods and services. I think that it is actually, my feeling is that it is a relatively neutral system. I don't think that there is any type of kind of pure capitalism. I think that capitalism always has rules established, and that there is no kind of like, well, this system is, I think a good example is kind of something like intellectual property laws, like the market can only exist when you have rules and regulations there. So capitalism is basically the the system that exists after you establish the rules, the rules of the road.
And what do you mean when you say that you view capitalism as a neutral system?
I don't think that it is inherently evil, but at the
same... Predicting my next question.
I was. Yet at the same time, I think that it is not inherently a force for good, and that you need to, you know, it is just a force, and it's a force that can be used in a variety of different ways. And I think that it's important that we recognize the awesome potential in capitalism to do good, but that we have to intentionally use it for those purposes, that this is not something that I think happens on its own.
You also talk in your report, as you need to, about the role of automation and outsourcing and what these mean. And I want to quickly, because I want to get to the kind of next piece of this discussion, which is, so what the heck do we do about this? Because you guys have some thoughts there, and we'll see what I think about them. in combination with those trends, if you know anyone who hasn't been living under a rock for the last 6 months has heard a heck of a lot about jobs being sent overseas and workers being replaced by machines. How much are those really factors here as well?
Oh, that's a good question. those are factors. I think that my understanding is that automation has had more of an impact than if you just look at manufacturing, that automation has had much more of an impact on the loss of manufacturing jobs than trade. Not to say that trade does not have a role, that outsourcing does not have a role. but generally speaking, the issue of automation is very difficult because, you know, this idea that the robots are just going to take all of our jobs is not something that we've really seen in the past. Automation generally does not lead to higher structural unemployment. It does lead to the types of jobs changing, right? I think that that's very important. It's also the case that if we are getting accelerating disruptions of automation, then it may be, you know, we may be reminded of the kind of Keynesian, you know, kind of like long run, right? Which is like, well, in the long run, it won't lead to structural unemployment. But if you keep having successive waves of automation, maybe the short term is everyone's just living in the short term, and those successive waves of automation continue to disrupt the economy, and you never actually get back to the long term. So it may be possible that we are nearing a point where automation does start changing how it impacts the economy. But I do think these are trends that are changing the economy, and ones that, you know, as we think about the social safety net and workers, we need to keep them in mind.
So I have a humble opinion to offer, which is that you didn't pick the right title for your report,
okay,
for your project. You really should have called it Make Capitalism Great Again.
Yeah.
Huge missed opportunity.
It was.
But I do want to ask, how do we make capitalism great again? If those are the problems, if those are the trends that we've seen, and if workers in many ways are suffering, the broader economy is suffering, you argue that a lot of what's out there, the kind of noise and din, is actually really set up based on a false choice. And I think it's important to start there before you walk through what you actually do call mm-hmm. for. You note in this report, some say we must restrict innovation and trade, and that we must use the coercive power of regulation to force businesses to revert to the economic models of the past, as you were describing before, getting back in that Wayback machine, in order to recapture the prosperity, the security, the upward mobility that previous generations have had. And what that's really hinged on, and what you describe as a false choice, is having to choose between where we are now and where we used to be. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear from you kind of what that would break down as in terms of what policies we would be reaching back to, and why those aren't the right path forward, and what the path forward looks like.
Yeah. So it is not the case that, you know, we shouldn't look back to any policies that, you know, of the past, to policies that we currently have. That, you know, we should obviously look at what currently works and continue what currently works, and not continue what doesn't. I know that's a very kind of like simplistic answer, but I also recognize that it's sometimes very easy for people to come in and just say, everything's not working, let's toss it all out. And we certainly don't want to do that. but at the same time, I think that it would be a mistake to rely entirely on that approach. I'm kind of reminded of the debate over climate change, and that there was always a tension.
Which shouldn't be a debate, but sure. It's somehow still a debate.
Well, I'm actually thinking about the debate within climate change activists, where there was always kind of a bit of tension between those that wanted to focus on emissions controls and those that wanted to focus on adaptation. And both were really important. And everyone agreed substantively they were important. The question was, you know, if you focus on adaptation too much, then are you kind of accepting this result, right? And our feeling is that, you know, we need to also, this is not a kind of like we shouldn't do this other thing, but I do think that, you know, looking at kind of the policy, the landscape of the policy debate, that there was really a need for an additional policy approach, one that did not just rely on the things that we've done, just like, okay, just do the same things, just push harder, but rather, you know, let's try to figure out some other innovative approaches and ones that may be a little more consistent and tailored to the economy that we have today. So we don't see these as like you can't do these other things, but I think that we feel like just relying on what we're doing now is unwise.
And when you say these other things, just because I feel like a lot of this can be very abstract,
sure,
and then
yeah.
breaking it down into what the policies are that we're really talking mm-hmm. about is helpful. Are you referring to policies such as wage floors, such as requiring certain types of benefits to be provided to workers, that kind of stuff that usually is sort of worker side, as
yeah.
opposed to thinking about what do we need to do to, I don't know, make things a little bit easier for employers to be better employers and to be better participants in capitalism?
Right, right. I think that's right. And, you know, again, we're not arguing against the current rules of the road at all. But just that, you know, I think the default approach that many people take is workers aren't getting X. Therefore, let's just make employers require, you know, require employers to provide X.
Employers are the villain.
Right. And one of the problems with that is that as technology makes it easier to reclassify employees as contractors, right, that it is easier and easier for businesses to say, okay, well, if all these strings are attached to the traditional employment relationship, I'm just not going to do that. And
just going to make everybody a contractor.
Just make everyone a
contractor.
Why
would I have employees?
Right. And that, I think, then As that weakens the overall approach of just relying on regulations that define the employment relationship. If businesses can just avoid the employment relationship entirely, that suggests to me that you need, not to say that you shouldn't also be regulating the employment relationship, but it does suggest to me that you also need an alternate approach. You need to start thinking about other ways that are not that are not related to, well, this is an employer, this is an employee, therefore the employer has certain responsibilities.
So Ethan, I'm on tenterhooks. What are the things that we could do to foster this mutual enterprise that don't just look like helping or empowering workers? What's the stuff on the business side?
Sure. So tenterhooks, I have not heard that word in a long
time.
Well,
then you clearly don't listen to my show because I say it all the time.
Really?
Really.
Oh, that I should listen to.
Bringing tenterhooks back again, making them sexy again.
Yeah. Sexy, interesting.
That one was for Rachel West, who is eternally trying to make unemployment insurance sexy again.
That's yeah. I'll give you an example. So the one of the approaches that we take is trying to make work kind of more of a mutual enterprise, giving businesses more of a stake in workers and workers more of a stake in businesses. So I'll give kind of one example for each of those two things. For giving businesses kind of a greater stake in their workers, right now, if they invest in their employees, they are, and this is what businesses tell us a lot, is that oftentimes they're worried that their employees will leave, to a different firm, and maybe even a competitor, in which case that competitor will then be using their investment against them, right? So we have a couple different ideas for tax credits to provide for employer provided training. One idea is just to, you know, you have, you know, similar to the research and development tax credit, where you provide a tax credit to a certain percentage of the total expense of the investment. Another approach, though, which I get kind of excited about, is instead you're providing a tax credit that roughly approximates how the actual impact that investment provided. So if we think that like a business is investing in an employee, that employee should become more productive. Well, that if they become more productive, one hopes at least that they would then be getting, you know, an increase in wages. Understand that's not always the case.
Hasn't been happening really since the 1970s. But I like your rosy spin.
Well, I think one of the reasons, there's many reasons for that. I do think that one of the reasons is that, you know, employer provided training is falling, but basically what you try to do is basically say, okay, look, if the employee gets invested in and, you know, gets trained and then leaves, that the tax credit provides the firm that invested in that person a certain, you know, it basically provides a smaller or larger tax credit based off of how well that worker does later on. Right, so for the next couple of years, for example, and so if that employee leaves, suddenly gets a big raise, then that initial business that made that investment still has a stake in it. So they don't need to worry as much about their employees leaving.
They don't have to worry about investing in someone and then losing that investment because that person took it, all those new credentials, the new qualifications,
exactly,
the new things that made them more marketable and left and took them elsewhere.
Exactly, and I think that changes how businesses will see investments in their workers. And they will focus maybe a little less on retention and a little more on just providing training investments that are actually in line with the business objectives in the first place.
You also call for making benefits, worker benefits, more portable, so yeah, that it reflecting kind of the changed nature of the employee-employer relationship. Because I mentioned unemployment insurance, you actually do have a big recommendation in there as well on kind of updating unemployment insurance to help workers relocate, so that they can go to where the jobs are. So in the last minute that I have with you, I want to ask your opinion on a New York Times article that ran this weekend, looking at the recent trend of wealthy Chinese families hiring butlers, and that they want butlers specifically who have been trained in the Downton Abbey style.
No way.
I'm totally serious. This was Front Page piece, right?
Did not see that.
You obviously don't follow me on Twitter either. Ethan, a lot's coming out today.
Well, not yet.
Well, look what you're missing. But here's the, it was actually a really interesting article, but here was the thing that just drove me nuts, and I just wanted, in the literally the last 30 seconds we have, ask you about this. The New York Times described this as the maturation of capitalism.
Yeah.
That, like, the wealthiest families in a country going out and getting butlers, clearly that is just, that's capitalism reaching its peak. Agree or disagree?
Well, I saw actually a tweet from someone else. I think it may have been Max Sawicki, who used to work at EPI a long time ago, but that paired two different photos. One was a photo advertising blood plasma donations for students, and the other was an advertisement for, I imagine, for rich people to get injected with the blood of young people. And and obviously these were totally separate photos, but they were put side by side and made the point, well, I guess capitalism has jumped straight to the harvesting the blood of the poor.
Which I guess answered the question I didn't have to ask earlier about whether capitalism is indeed evil.
I would say that that is an unfortunate contrast of the two. I think that, I just to be clear, I think that capitalism is an awesome force that can be used very much for good. And I think that it's really important to just get the incentives right and to be very intentional about how we think about, you know, what output we want capital, you know, what goals we want capitalism to achieve. And I think that if we think about it in a very inclusive way, then I think that everyone's better off.
Ethan Pollack on a quest to make capitalism great again. The report is actually called Toward a New Capitalism. It comes in two parts. One tells you about the problem. The other describes the solutions, and you can find them on Aspen Institute's website. Ethan, thank you for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And that's the show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. You can find us anytime at www.talkpoverty.org/podcast, where we have a full archive of all past shows. You can also listen to us anytime as a podcast on iTunes. And send us your pitches to info@talkpoverty.org. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford 'cause my block.